OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 150 of Sign Language. It's been a long break between drinks, I know, but the last 6 to 8 weeks, I've pretty much poured every spare minute of my life into working on this movie of Chad's. And I think it was Rob Bettler reached out to me and said, you know, talk us through the process. You know, there's bound to be some people who'd be interested in hearing, you know, what you're going through, what you're learning, and so on and so forth. So I thought, okay, well, I'll discuss that. Now that I'm sort of in a bit of a lull at the moment. Chad's got a bunch of other stuff on his plate at the moment. So I've sent him a mix of the movie, just a stereo mix at this point. And he's going to be a few days before he actually gets around to listening to it. So I've kind of got some downtime, which is kind of enjoyable. So the process. Chad has edited the movie in Adobe Premiere Pro and obviously, you know, edited all the vision and the sync sound. That's the sound that is recorded to, you know, external audio devices, but with time code synchronization along with the time code going to the cameras that were capturing the picture. So all that stuff was laid up in Premiere Pro. So what Chad did was he exported what's called an OMF, which stands for Open Media Framework, I think it is. And essentially, it's like the audio equivalent of a zip file. It allows you to create this one file that has all of the audio assets that are required for, you know, this particular project. And it's one of those... Well, I don't think it's an open standard, but it's designed that, you know, in such a way that there are multiple digital audio workstations and digital nonlinear video editing platforms that will support the OMF format, which essentially allows you to interchange, you know, projects between different systems so that, like in this instance, different people can work on the project, you know, in their software of choice. So Chad created an OMF of all of the sync sound, so all of the, you know, actors talking, and it included, this particular movie has a narration track that pretty much runs through the whole 7.5 minutes. So he'd recorded that narration with his daughter, because she's the narrator of the movie. So all of that audio was in the OMF as well. And there were a couple of basic bits of ambiences and, you know, location sound that had been recorded by the guy who was doing the location sound for Chad. So all that stuff was in the OMF. So, you know, we used Google Drive to basically move assets backwards and forwards between Chad and me, and then from me back to Chad. So I ended up with about 12 gigabytes of stuff to download and imported. Well, actually, I opened it as an OMF in, I think it was in Adobe Audition first, and then ran the Adobe Audition file through AA Translator, which Mick Rooney has very generously set me up with a copy of, and translated the Audition track lay into a Reaper compatible track lay, because I'm now, you know, 100% using Reaper. And so that allowed me to, you know, have all of the assets laid up in their correct time code positions on the timeline. I was able to then, you know, set a start time for the project of, you know, 58 minutes, which gave me a couple of minutes of just blank space at the head of the project. And then all of the project audio started from the 1 hour time point, which is apparently a fairly common practice in the, you know, video and film world. So then music-wise, Chad had recorded an orchestra. He commissioned a 20-piece orchestra. He booked this chapel somewhere in Seattle that apparently is quite famous and has been used a lot for recording film soundtracks and musical scores. And apparently, according to Chad, the musical score for the movie Mr. Holland's Opus, which starred Richard Dreyfuss, was recorded in this particular chapel. So Chad was of the mindset that this chapel has some heritage in the movie industry, and, you know, when he hired an orchestra, they would be pretty keen to record there because of the, you know, the history of this place. So they went, they recorded, but the issue was that the orchestra that he hired, these 20 guys, they didn't actually play together regularly as an orchestra. It was, you know, this guy plays a viola and that guy plays a violin and this guy's a cellist, and, you know, they were all just individual musicians who came together on the day as an orchestra, but they'd not had an opportunity to record prior or to even rehearse prior to the day of recording. So fair to say that, you know, the day wasn't probably as smooth as Chad would have liked it to have been. You know, there were some lumps in the performance. But the guy that did the recording did an absolutely fantastic job of it. And so Chad had this massive task of trying to find individual phrases from various takes of the 12 musical cues that he'd written for this movie, and stitch them all together so that he ended up with a good take of each musical cue. Now, before he decided to record an orchestra, he had just written the music and did it all as MIDI. And I think he was using Propellerhead's Reason. And then somewhere along the line, he thought, you know, if I'm going to do this, I really should do it properly, should get an orchestra. So he got the orchestra. And then the orchestral thing, you know, didn't quite live up to expectations as much as he would have hoped. So he came to the idea of, let's do a hybrid score where the orchestra had played to a metronome, thankfully. So that meant that we could use both the MIDI performance and the live orchestral performance and create this hybrid orchestral score that was part orchestra, part MIDI. But obviously, you know, there was lots of editing to do of the live orchestra parts and lots of, you know, mixing involved. So basically, I ended up with another OMF, which had all of the orchestral score, and then all of the separate zip files of all of the individual WAV components that Chad had rendered out from Reason of all of the, you know, MIDI instruments for each cue. So there's this massive track lathe, you know, so I created a completely separate project just for the orchestral stuff. So I had, you know, these 12 musical cues laid along the timeline, and there were about 20 tracks of the live orchestra performance. Like I said, the guy who did the recording of it did an absolutely brilliant job. He did a three-mic Decca tree behind the conductor, so a left, a center, and a right microphone. Then he did a wide pair, so they were probably a couple of meters either side of the conductor as a stereo pair. And then he did a high pair, which were about 3 meters up in the air over the top of the orchestra. And then he had a bunch of spot microphones on various sections of the orchestra. So all of that, yeah, I think it was about 18 tracks, I think it was, for the orchestra. And so then along, you know, let's say cue number one, you know, started at zero time code. I then had all of the tracks that made up the MIDI portion of cue number one, which might have been another, you know, 18 odd tracks. And then further down the timeline where cue number two began, I then brought in all the MIDI parts and created a whole new set of tracks in the Reaper project for them. So if you look at the screen capture, I'll put the screen capture up on the show notes for this episode, so you can see the way I had it laid out in Reaper. I thought about trying to merge all of the MIDI parts into the least number of tracks across all 12 cues, but the trouble was there was so much automation going on, it actually ended up being a lot simpler to just keep each musical cue from the MIDI side of things on its own bunch of tracks. So it didn't share the same tracks as the MIDI parts for any other musical cues within the whole project. When you look at the screen capture, you'll understand. So that project ended up with over 200 audio tracks in it, but, you know, really, at any one point in time, there was probably no more than 30, 35 audio tracks playing at once, you know, 18 of which were the live orchestra and the remainder of which were the rendered WAV files of the MIDI parts. So, yeah, the mixing of the music ended up being a much bigger project than I think either Chad or I had allowed for. I set aside 4 days of annual leave in the middle of October, and I'd said to Chad probably 2 or 3 weeks prior, I said, look, I'm going to take these 4 days off as annual leave, and those are the 4 days where we're going to do the final mix of the movie, because I want to have a finite goal, you know, an end point locked down where we say this is when it's going to be done by. And we were working towards that, but like I said, the whole, you know, mixing of the music proved to be a much bigger issue than we gave it credit for, and we just ended up so far behind the eight ball, there was no way we were going to get finished by the Friday that I'd earmarked. So while Chad was, you know, chomping away, trying to edit all these orchestral parts together to make, you know, coherent performances of each musical cue, I was working on all of the rest of the sound design for the movie, which involved, first of all, taking all of the tracks that I'd got from the OMFs, you know, or one OMF of all of the sync sound plus the narration, laying all that up in Reaper, you know, based on the output of audio AA translator, and, you know, then doing some housekeeping, you know, setting up parent folders for ambiences. Within that, 2 more parent folders, one for indoor ambiences and one for outdoor ambiences. I then ended up with, I think it was only about 4 tracks for indoor ambiences and probably 8 or 12 tracks for outdoor ambiences. And it wasn't because there was going to be 8 or 12 outdoor ambiences per scene. It was so that I could checkerboard from scene to scene. So I might have had, you know, 2 or 3 ambiences for any given scene, but then I needed to be able to go to another set of 2, 3, 4 tracks for the scene that followed, you know, rather than having clips overlapping, you know, at the scene cut, because then if you needed to make radical volume adjustments, you were trying to make, you know, massive jumps in a one frame time span, you know, so it just didn't make sense to do that. It made much more sense to checkerboard things across the track lay. So I had all of the ambiences. Then I had a new parent folder for sound effects. Within that, I had one track dedicated to just body, I called it body movement, because there was this one location that kept appearing in the movie where these two girls were lying on the floor of a wooden hut. And so I had just these very subtle wood creak and, you know, body moving on, you know, creaky wood kind of sounds. So they occupied just one track. And then I had probably about 14 or 15 tracks for just, you know, any other sound effects that I needed to put in. Then I had another parent folder for footsteps. And within that, I had, I don't know, 4, 6 tracks of footstep sound effects. Most scenes didn't need any, but then there were other scenes that needed lots. So you just built them up as you needed them. Then there was a bunch of sound design that had been done by another guy that Chad had been working with before I became involved. And this guy, Jake, I think I might have mentioned Jake in the last episode, did some absolutely gorgeous sound design for a night scene in the middle of the movie where there's this massive explosion, and a scene at the main scene at the end of the movie, which is probably the last minute and a half of the movie, where there was some magic being performed. This is kind of a science fantasy type film. So he did some sound design for the for the magic stuff, and then there's this demon that appears, and he did some absolutely amazing sound design for this demon. So all of those things were laid up on their own set of tracks for each of those three elements, and each of those elements probably had, you know, 12 to 15 tracks as well. So there was all that stuff that pretty much wrapped up all of the sound effects and sound design stuff. Then I had another parent folder for dialogue. Within that I had the narration. Then I had all the sync dialogue from the actors, you know, captured on screen, on set. And then below that I had another parent folder for the musical score. And then I had inside that there were two tracks for the rough MIDI mixes that Chad had initially done straight out of Reason. And then there was the stuff that once I got it all mixed, the hybrid score, I was then going to bring in, you know, the finished mixes into new tracks within that folder. So again, you know, this master project ended up with 156 tracks or thereabouts. Plus, of course, you know, then I added buses for various reverbs. So I had a sort of a slapback echo for out in the woods. There were some scenes out in the, you know, like in the forest. I had a bit of a slapback echo for out there. I had a couple of different indoor reverbs for a couple of different indoor scenes that occur throughout the movie. I then had just this massive reverb, you know, which was using like a 10-second impulse reverb, which was used for a couple of special effects throughout the movie. So all my reverbs were done as sends from various tracks. So if a track needed to go to any particular reverb, I would just set up a send from that track to whatever reverb was necessary. Throughout the majority of the movie, that send would be at zero, you know, minus infinity, and then for whatever scene that particular track needed to feed to whatever particular reverb it was, I would then just have the send automate to send some of that track to the reverb. So when we got all of that stuff track laid, I started thinking that I was going to be doing a 5.1 mix first up. I went and converted the entire project to a 5.1 mix, and that was unfortunately quite an epic job, because it meant that for every audio track in Reaper, you would go to there's an I/O button that handles all the input and output for every track. And so you bring up this I/O button and you would change the number of channels from 2, which is the default, to 6, you know, it's because you needed 5.1. And I had to go through and I had to manually do that for every single track in the project. And I don't know if there was a way to, you know, batch convert every track from 2-channel output to 6-channel output. But if there was, I certainly didn't find it. So it took ages to go through and convert all these tracks to 6-channel output. Then I had to find a VST plugin to act as a surround panner. And thankfully, Reaper comes with a very competent surround panner built in, and like all of the Reaper built-in plugins, it's called Re-something. In this case, it's Re-surround. And so, you know, I then had to add that to every track that I wanted to pan through the 5.1 space. So came these 4 days where I was going to do the final mix, and I've started doing the 5.1 mix. Got it to a point where I thought it was, you know, at least, you know, I knew it wasn't finished, but I thought it was in a good place and it was worth sending a mix over to Chad for him to have a listen to. So I've output a 5.1 mix as a 6-channel interleaved WAV file, threw that up on Google Drive, said, here you go, have a listen. He comes back to me and he's going, oh, dude, this sounds weird and that sounds weird. And now, up until this point, Chad had absolutely loved every single thing that I'd done, and I'm thinking, this is really weird, you know, like he suddenly got all these you know, massive issues with the sound of what I'm doing. And I thought, this is odd. And it made me start to question, what kind of system is Chad listening on? You know, is it set up properly? Is there an issue whereby the track allocation isn't being read properly from the 6-channel interleaved WAV file? Because there are different, you know, formats for laying out the 6-channel, you know, mix. And I was using the SMPTE ITUR spec, which is left front, right front, center, LFE, that's your subwoofer, and then left surround, right surround. But I do know that there are other formats where the order is different. So I'm thinking, oh, is he, you know, getting the LFE track and the, you know, surround channels or something? And, you know, I had no idea what was going on. So we kicked a few ideas around, and eventually he said to me, look, you know what? 90% of people who watch this movie are going to listen to it in stereo. Let's work on getting a stereo mix first. Okay. So I then had to create a new version of the project, which, if you know me, I do this all the time anyway. I never overwrite a project file, or at least any day that I come to the project again, I save a new version with that day's date. So I end up with, you know, multiple copies of the project file, the way they finished on any given day of work, right? So if everything went pear-shaped with what I was working on the 13th, I could go back to the file marked the 12th and know that, you know, that version of the file was exactly how I finished when I stopped work on the 12th, you know? So I could always go back to a previous day if I had to. On top of that, I had Reaper set up to be saving time-stamped backups of every move. And I think I had it set to every 5 minutes. So every 5 minutes had a special designated folder on another hard drive where Reaper would, in the background, just create a new backup every 5 minutes of the project I was working on. And the reason I did that was because I was having massive problems with my system overheating. And it was constantly blue screening on me. And I got to the point where I'd, you know, lose maybe 15, 20 minutes of work. And the worst part was not losing the 15 or 20 minutes work, as frustrating as that was. But the worst part was not knowing exactly what I was up to at the point of the previous save. And going, yeah, you'd reboot the system, you'd open the file back up, and you go, oh, did I include that automation tweak before I last saved or after I last saved? Yeah, you know, and so you just never knew how much you'd done, what you'd missed, what you'd left out. So, so I've got hundreds of copies of this project now. So when he says to me, let's just work on a stereo mix, I then saved a new copy, saved it as, you know, put in brackets, stereo, then had to go through, change all the channel outputs back to to 2-channel rather than 6-channel. And so this is where we're at the moment. I've now, you know, worked on this mix. And the other thing, and this was a simple, I guess, communication error between Chad and myself, and not necessarily communication error, as because we're both new to it. We maybe just didn't know what questions we needed to be asking each other. So I naturally assumed that what he wanted was a very dynamic, cinematic type of mix, you know, where you aim for dialogue to be, you know, minus 24 dB full scale, and, you know, you'd mix everything around the dialogue so that you've got, you know, 20 plus dB of headroom for things like explosions and all that sort of stuff. And when I sent him a mix, he came back to me and he went, mate, it just all sounds really quiet. No matter how much I turn it up, it just sounds weak and lifeless. And so the more he described it to me, the more I was thinking to myself, he really wants a really heavily compressed mix. And so I wrote back to him and I said, man, it sounds like this is what you're wanting, which is completely not what I thought you wanted. And so I then sent him off to my SoundCloud profile. I went, look, go to soundcloud.com/audio2u, have a listen to particularly this commercial for Etihad Airways, you know, which was a spot I made a few years back and I really liked. I said, it's at least a little bit like listening to a movie, you know, it's very bit cinematic, but it's radio production, so it is fairly compressed and, you know, everything's there. He came back to me and went, mate, that's exactly what I'm trying to get to. And he said, and even more so, he said, you had another commercial for Barocca. He said, and that's exactly what I want. I went, okay, fine. So at least now we're on the same page. We know what you're after. So then I went back and, you know, plugged in more compressors and really started to mix it the way I would mix for radio, which was a completely different approach to what I had been trying to do. And yeah, and so that was a week and a half ago, and he was like, yeah, it's getting there, it's really sounding good, but there's still some things to do, and yada, yada, yada. So yeah, so that's where we're at. I've sent him a new mix, he's tied up with some other things, and, you know, hopefully over the next week or so, he will, you know, find the time to get around to actually have a listen to that last mix that I've sent him, and, you know, fingers crossed, there'll only be, you know, a few more tweaks to make. And we're just going to get the stereo mix absolutely nailed. Once we've got the stereo mix in the bag, I will then go back through, change all of the tracks to 6-channel. Although, the more I think about it, the more I'm thinking sound effects and Foley are all going to stay in the front channels. And it'll really only be the ambiences and the musical score which are going to fill the surround channels. So, yeah, once I get the stereo mix nailed, we can then approach the 5.1 mix, which is kind of now, you know, taken a second row seat. And that kind of makes sense. As much as the, I was all excited about the 5.1, and I still am, and have enjoyed the process and have enjoyed the learning that has come along with it. I can understand why it's not the primary thing, because as he said, you know, the majority of people are just going to hear a stereo mix. So as much as we, you know, wish that were not the case, that's the reality. All right, well, I've rambled on about that way longer than I had planned to. So I'm just going to quickly go through a couple of other things that I've collected over the last 6 weeks in my little text document of things to discuss on sign language. One is, you would know by now that I am a fairly big fan of iZotope's plugins. They have leaked on their website that Ozone 7 is not far away, with supposedly a whole bunch of new features. RX5 has now come out. That's been updated from RX4. From what I've heard, you know, from audio groups on Facebook that I'm part of, guys are saying, if you're on RX3, it's kind of worth the upgrade, but if you're on RX4, the jump to RX5 is really not that spectacular. So check it out if you're interested in noise reduction and all the funky things that RX5 is capable of. There's some great stuff in there. Somewhere way, 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 way back, somebody sent me a link to a YouTube video of this guy with his electron microscope trying to capture images of a needle in a vinyl groove via electron microscope and turn it into an animation so that you could see, you know, what it looks like when the needle is tracking in the groove of a piece of vinyl. And he's made this 9.5-minute video, and it's really interesting stuff, and the things he had to go through in order to capture this image, it's crazy. Had to completely rip apart the, you know, the cartridge and the stylus head of the, you know, the stylus for the vinyl, the turntable, and create all kinds of things. Had to remove bits that were, you know, magnetic, because that would affect the electron microscope, and Then he had to cut up pieces of vinyl, but vinyl wouldn't work because of something to do with the material. So he had to put the pieces of vinyl in a vacuum and spray them with vaporized silver so that they would, you know, the electrons from the microscope would have something to reflect off. Yeah, it was really fascinating stuff. But about 5 minutes into this video, he talks about a thing called a capacitance electronic disc. And this is a format I'd never heard of. Apparently RCA developed it. And it's kind of like Laserdisc, for those who were around in the 80s and remember Laserdisc, in that it's a 12-inch disc. But this was an analog format, kind of like vinyl, but with a much, much higher track density. He actually shows you images of the needle from his vinyl record resting on this capacitance electronic disc, and you can see that the grooves are super, super tiny in comparison with the grooves of a vinyl record. And it was one of those formats whereby the disc was in a plastic cartridge, and the artwork for the movie was printed on the outside of the cartridge, but the whole cartridge would go into whatever the hardware player was that played these discs, and the disc would then be extracted from inside its cartridge whilst it was inside the player. A little bit like the Denon cartridge CD players that radio stations were using throughout the 90s, for anyone who ever encountered those. I've never seen this format, and I'd never heard of it until I saw it on this YouTube video. So whoever it was that sent me that link, thank you. It's very interesting. I really enjoyed that little 9-minute video, and obviously I'll put the link in the show notes for anyone that wants to check it out. It's worth it for the whole electron microscope view of the needle in the vinyl record. Fascinating stuff. Okay, and you're going to think I'm kidding, but I'm actually ready to talk about compression again. No, I'm serious. But I'm going to save that for the next episode. And the reason that I'm ready to talk about it again is because I learned something new about compression over the last week, and it's absolutely blown my mind. So I'm just going to leave you with that teaser. I'll bring up that discussion in the next episode. So yeah, that'll do it for this week. Good to get an episode out. My apologies for the delay. And yeah, if any comments, questions, feedback, please drop me an email, studio@audiotu.com. And until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotu.com.